Hello and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I have with me a good friend, Derek Brower, who's going to help us risk the outcome of the U.S. election. Now, there's some of you out there who might be worried that I just grabbed some plant from a deep blue state, since I sometimes talk about the energy evolution and probably don't agree with OPEC's view of oil growth over the next 2 decades. But no, Derek's the senior political editor at the Financial Times, and he's been covering the election from all angles. So, Derek, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew.
But wait, there's more. Previously, Derek was the energy editor at the FT, covering shale, oil sands, IRA, clean tech, all that good stuff. In fact, he's covered energy and politics for the last 25 years across the Middle East, North Africa, Russia. He lived in Russia, studied in Russia, got his PhD in Russia. He's covered conflicts from Somalia and Iraq to Libya, and spent some time in the Middle East during the Arab Spring. I also remember getting a call from you a couple of years ago from Kiev, which seemed terrifying to me at the time. And of course, like I said, a lot of time in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Gulf, all the Gulf states. And so yeah, did I miss anything?
That's good enough.
Good enough. All
That's
right.
too much.
So yeah, too much. It's only a 30-minute show. We got to keep moving. So as usual, I'd like to start off by asking you a couple of questions so the audience gets to know you better. Cool.
Go.
All right, Derek. What was the first concert that you ever went to?
Harry Connick Jr. in the Odeon in Manchester. Not very cool answer, but that's the true one.
No, truth is good. I'm sure it was a memorable moment, formative years. All right, next question. Beach or mountains? Now, remember this is a year-round commitment, not seasonal.
Mountains, hands down.
Just not an ocean kind of guy. It's
Fly
not a lake or.
fishing, skiing, you name it.
All right, I hear you. All right, so based on what I just described above, I think I know the answer to this question, but. And based on your accent, still know the answer to this question. Have you been to more states or countries?
I think it's countries still. I have been to a lot of states now. I haven't been to all 50, but I'm working my way up the poll. But I
You
think it's
still got time.
about 37 states, and I think about 55 countries.
Ooh, well, apparently you're not going to be able to actually flip that, even if you get to all 50.
That's yeah, true.
Yeah, just
Unless
saying.
something big changes. Who
That
knows?
would be a
Maybe
thing.
we'll after the election. Who knows?
No, we'll talk through that. We'll see if we can get there. All right, next. What's the best energy source?
I'm going to say the sun, but not necessarily solar. The sun, just because I'm hedging my bets, saying the sun is a source of all other energy sources, as we know, including the plankton that then delivers fossil fuels.
So diplomatic here on Morning Energy Live. Great. All right, finally, what is the best sandwich?
In New York City right now, and I have to say, Reuben, I mean, it is.
I mean, it's a really good sandwich. It's
It's a good sandwich.
not very hard to argue. It's in
It's a
the
good sandwich.
pantheon of sandwiches for sure.
Yeah,
For
yeah,
sure.
yeah.
All right, good stuff. Thank you for that. Now let's get into the heart of the topic at hand. So, look, you and I have talked a lot about this topic, about the election and the implications in particular for the energy sector. And so, I think they're both domestic impacts, but I'd actually like to start on the international side, because frankly, I
Sure.
think the whoever sort of is in the White House next year is going to have a far greater impact on the international front than on the domestic front. So, what do you see as the economic and then energy impacts based on who wins?
Well, it's pretty difficult. And I think actually you're right to start with the foreign, because the domestic, we kind of have to get into Congress and all that. But actually, on foreign policy, foreign energy relations, the president can really do a lot. It's hard to imagine, and at the outset, I've got to say, I don't have a dog in this fight. Obviously, I'm a Brit. I live here. To that extent, I do, but I'm just calling it as I see it. And I would say the past 4 years have been pretty disastrous from a U.S. foreign policy perspective, which was a surprise, because I think as Biden entered office, a lot of people looked at his past in the Senate and as vice president with an expertise in foreign affairs, and thought they were in the hands, the U.S. was in the hands of a real expert on foreign policy. events have overtaken the US, and the US looks very passive. And as far as foreign policy affects energy prices, energy policy in the US and so on right now, I would say we're dealing with an extreme geopolitical risk environment. Let's put it that way. We are literally hours away, potentially, or days away from Israel potentially striking Iranian energy facilities. We know that they've discussed that because Joe Biden has asked them not to do it, warned them against doing it. Our own reporting at the Financial Times, we've spoken to people inside the room who know that this is a possible outcome of the tensions between Israel and Iran right now. So at the moment, we are in an environment that could not really get more risky, I think, for oil markets, for natural gas supplies out of the Persian Gulf, and so on. So what happens after the election? Well, I think there isn't, it's very hard to, starting with Kamala Harris, there isn't really enough to go on to say that she would be very different from Joe Biden. Her advisors are in the same vein of somewhat realpolitik view of the world, from America's place in the world, and seeing America as the essential nation that must defend allies and stand up for democracy, and all these things we've heard repeated from the foreign policy blob in DC over decades. She's very much in the center of that political environment in DC, I would say. Well, that's kind of where what her foreign policy ideology would spring up from. And her advisors are, for example, Phil Gordon, who's her most important foreign policy advisor. You know, these are people that have been around for a long time. They've been part of that establishment. They spent time in Europe with allies and so on. That's her view of the world. She said it in her speech in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention, which she said, you know, she wants to remind allies that the US is going to be there for them. What would that mean for, say, Middle East policy? Well, I think it means sticking by Israel. She's been clear about that. Keeping the defensive or offensive posture of the US military in the Middle East. I suspect she'll be slightly more pragmatic throughout if she's elected than Biden was at the outset. Let's remember, at the outset, Biden had put human rights and other more ideological aspects at the heart of his relationship with Saudi Arabia, for example. Mm-hmm. They had to flip on that when oil prices rose and they patched up relations with Mohammed bin Salman and so on. I think Kamala Harris would expect to be a bit more of that kind of second half of the Biden administration's more pragmatic view of relations with Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, and so on. With regards to Russia, she's been clear. She was clear again this week in her interview with 60 Minutes. She's not going to negotiate an end to the war immediately without the Ukrainians being involved. She does not see Putin as an honest broker in this at all. I think the US would just carry on as it has, being quite hostile, but not fully engaged in fighting against the Russians. Donald Trump is completely different. And I think it's very, very hard to predict whether he would succeed in his two big claims, ending the war in Ukraine and ending the conflict in and around Israel as quickly as he says. It's hard to see how he would do that. He hasn't given any details, but we do know that 4 years with Donald Trump had much less fighting. So
yeah,
we also know that he's extremely isolationist. His whole view of American power is about keeping it at home, strong military, but not engaging in foreign conflicts. So I'd make no judgment on the ideological kind of validity of either of those stances, but they are very different. One of them would be much more isolationist. And I think that would make it much more difficult to predict where those risks to energy supplies, energy exports from the Gulf would come from under Donald Trump. But it may be that we go back to an environment that is kind of status quo ante, where there wasn't actually conflict that the US was engaged in. It's a bit of a long-winded answer to say that I think it's very unpredictable. I think it's much easier to say Kamala Harris will stick with what we're seeing
business
now.
Business as usual. Trump or not. It'll be different. And I guess, you know, the fact that over the last 10 years, you know, with shale revolution plus, North America's for energy independent. And so some of the risks are less than they would have been half a generation ago. However, unrest in Middle East and in Eastern Europe and in potentially China could create even more disruption in and around, like the way we saw maybe during COVID, like supply chains and stuff like that. So
the one thing I would add, though, is that we have to also talk about trade and the kind of macroeconomic environment. And both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are heading down a much more protectionist route. And this era of kind of deglobalization is underway. But Trump is far more hostile to both allies, but also to China on trade. And in as much as that would affect global economic growth, I think we have to take that seriously. I think it did in during his trade wars in 2017. And it probably would again if he ignites new trade conflicts with China.
All right, so not much at stake. Just, business as usual. All right, well, let's bring it back home then. I mean, we can touch on the Iran-Israel risk maybe towards the end and think about what that might mean for oil prices. But as we're thinking specifically about the election, a lot of listeners, I think, are focused on a few things. One, LNG. Two, the IRA and the Infrastructure Act, whether or not that can be reversed or how quickly it could be reversed. Offshore drilling, offshore wind, permitting reform, more importantly, that's just been getting louder and louder over the last few weeks in my circles for sure. And then, EPA, all these sort of domestic topics. So why don't we start, let's start with LNG. Let's say, okay, there's the Biden pause. Does it matter who wins the election? Are we still going to have a pause on new LNG infrastructure in North America or in the US? Sorry.
If Trump wins the election, he will gut a lot of the agencies that are being very active or have been very active under Biden. There will not be a pause. The study will go away. There will not be a pause. I think if Kamala Harris wins the election, there's a high chance that the study goes away as well. It's caused undue stress for the administration to no discernible benefit to anybody, including allies. So I don't think there's a massive political constituency to keep the LNG pause in place. There are Democrats, progressive Democrats who, for environmental reasons or because of, for example, some of them claiming that it raises the price of fuel in the US, would try and keep it in place. But I think that pause probably goes away after the election, whoever wins, but certainly if Trump wins.
Certain, right. No, that makes sense. Okay, so the other rhetoric we hear is around the IRA and some of these other plans that have been passed over the last 4 years. Do they roll back? Are they law? I mean, we know what they are, but like, are they able to be changed? Does it matter? Do we have to worry about Congress? Like, how should we think about the IRA infrastructure, these bills that have come through?
I think the IRA in particular, because it's a 10-year program and it's in legislation, is pretty safe, to be honest. Politically, it makes sense right now for Donald Trump to rail against it because it has all the kind of Bidenomics kind of vibe to it and green energy and stuff. And among his voters in particular, that's all unpopular. But the reality of this is that to get rid of it, he would, A, need both chambers of Congress and probably supermajority in the Senate to do it, because it is law. It is law. Right. You have to be legislation that repealed it. This is different from hobbling the EPA or taking on the agencies or using the courts to do something. This is law. It's going to stay there unless he gets enough people in Congress to agree with him that he repeals it. And it's not clear that he really wants to repeal it or that the people, especially in kind of red districts around the country, Republican districts, where there's suddenly jobs being created. Look at Georgia, for example. Governor is Republican. Marjorie Taylor Greene, very, very kind of MAGA politician in a district in Georgia. Her district benefiting from some of the jobs that are arriving because of the Inflation Reduction Act. So it'd be very difficult for her and others like her to decide that they want to get rid of this. They can rail against it. It's good politics for them on the right side of American politics to rail against this. getting rid of it is not going to happen. What could happen is that a bunch of the stuff that like there's a lot of snagging left to do with the Inflation Reduction
Act. I was going to ask you about, like, there's like certain timelines on certain credits and like how to qualify for credits. Like, that's not all ironed out yet, right? So
it's not all ironed out, and that's
what could change.
You could throw a lot of sand in the gears, that stuff, because a lot of that is being defined by the agencies. Like, Treasury Department has to weigh in on tax credit transfers and all that kind of stuff. And they could throw a lot of sand in those gears. And you could also, I guess, the permitting issue, which I'm sure we're going to come to. The permitting issue is the other big snag that is holding back the IRA from actually doing what's the federal government wanted it to, what the Biden administration wanted it to do. I mean, one really important thing to know about the IRA, I think, is that although there's a lot of promised investment, it is going slower than I think the Biden administration expected or hoped. And that's because there is a lot of detail and there's a lot of fiddly little stuff that has to happen to get your hands on credits. And a lot of people are spending a lot of money trying to figure that out. And it's not like they're just throwing money at it in the way that they're being accused. There's a lot of steps that people have to go through to get that money. And all those steps can be slowed if anybody really wanted to slow it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the investment community's biggest challenge right now, right? They see the IRA, they see all the potential, but the government hasn't de-risked these projects enough for them to make long-term commitments to whatever it is that, whether it's a carbon capture or hydrogen or you name it, project that they're trying to incentivize. And I guess until that's ironed out one way or the other, you're not going to see those dollars getting out the door or those credits getting out the door.
Yeah. For sure. On the other hand, if you speak to kind of private equity people who are investing in, I'm sure you do, in the clean energy space, a lot of them have said to me in the past, you know, actually some of our best years were under Trump. And that's just because the market is what it is. And the IRA is giving big, or in theory is giving a big tailwind to market forces. But on deployment of clean energy, that train has kind of left the station. It's happening.
The pace
is variable, but it's underway. The investment is still coming in.
Yeah. It's just the scale. So the other, I guess, challenge that investors have and corporations have is permitting. And it's a problem for power. It's a problem for traditional energy. It's a problem for renewables. It's a problem across the board. And so, you know, we know that Manchin and someone else has the bill.
Yep,
that one. Thank you. You know, sort of sitting there, hard to do anything before this election's over, of course. I hear varying opinions on if it has legs or not in Congress. Does it? And if it doesn't, how do we get permitting reform? And how does it look under the different administrations next?
Well, it's definitely not happening before the election because there's no legislative time left. After the election, I think there's two, this is a really funny thing, and I think it's like kind of like almost a game theory situation. And also as a foreigner, it's absolutely amazing to watch how this works in Congress because there is a huge constituency that wants permitting reform. Progressives want it because they want to build more houses, they want to build more transmission lines for green energy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives want it because they can build more pipelines, all those things. So it's everybody wants some kind of permitting reform, except the NIMBYs. And those NIMBYs, the not in my backyard people, are pretty powerful and they come in odd places. They come in districts like the one I'm in with a bunch of rich liberals who do not want to see stuff built, new houses built that lower their housing prices and so on. So
well, they don't want to see the windmills off like from their beach either. You know, that ruins
nobody wants to see windmills off Martha's Vineyard. They don't want to see them off down the shore either. So I mean, there's this kind of latent, what's a better way? Maybe like the stasis that's built in because when it comes to it, even though everybody knows this is essential to doing whatever it is you want to do on energy, whatever it is that you want to do on building new houses to solve a housing crisis, you need permitting reform. End of story. Yeah. It is the biggest problem. What's the biggest obstacle to getting any of this done? And yet,
here we are.
I am pretty gloomy about its prospects I'll be amazed. I'll be really amazed to see a bill go through. There's always going to be this situation where the progressives say, well, hang on a sec, that's just going to create more pipelines. And where conservatives say, well, hang on a sec, that's just going to give, it's going to accelerate the clean energy transition.
So no matter who wins, it's going to be the same challenge getting any permanent reform through.
I think so. And the longer it goes on, the more obvious.
Yeah.
No, the longer it looks absurd. It looks absurd that people in Boston are basically burning LNG that comes in from across the world when they're, the Marcellus is so close. It looks absurd that you can have wind in Wyoming that can't get to the kind of booming population centers in the Southwest because of permitting problems on the transmission lines. Like, this is all absurd. Everybody knows it's absurd.
Yeah.
But Congress does a lot of absurd things, and one of them is standing in the way of permitting reform.
You know, I'm curious, and we can skip to this topic here. Look, power demand hasn't grown in two decades. It's growing now. We know what's pushing that growth forward. It's data centers, it's EVs, it's a handful of other things. But really, it's the tech companies. And so do you think the tech companies getting involved in some of this lobbying around permit reform in particular, because they need that in order to quench their energy thirst, do you think that will help grease the wheels of justice, as they say?
I think that would be the best chance if the corporate interests in DC become so overwhelming that nobody can stand in the way of this. By the way, let's remember that Manchin may not be around to kind of usher this through
Congress
himself anyway. So that the current bill as it stands probably is dead in the water anyway. But yeah, I mean, maybe Google, if it emerges as a single company from the antitrust investigations right now, maybe the others will bring their power to bear. It would make sense. But again, this has made sense ever since the deal on the IRA was struck, and there just hasn't been any progress on it. And everything, this is not, this doesn't even include what might happen to the Congress that is about to be elected, or who would be in charge of it, and so on. And on that, we don't know.
Yeah.
Like, we really, really don't know. It could be, I think everybody on the street is hoping that it's
deadlock.
A divided government deadlock.
Yeah.
But let's see. I'm skeptical that permitting reform gets done.
Right. Well, I guess the other part, and it ties back to the tech companies and the growth in power demand, does how we address those needs as a nation change depending on who's in office? Do we get more gas or more nukes or more something else based on the next 4 years, or we're just sort of marching down with whoever we got?
I think it'll be on the margins for both. I know Trump will say he wants to accelerate nuclear rollout. So, sort of the Biden administration, by the way, that he'll, natural gas must be deployed more. Again, natural gas also depends on the permitting reform question. So it'll be on the margins. Yes, there'll be more fossil fuels, or fossil fuels have a longer life, one would assume, retain a larger share under Trump, presumably. There will be, I think, to the extent that he can change some of the rules in the agencies, he will do that.
Mm.
That's for sure. He can do that with executive power. To the extent that he can decide to, he can compel or find some way of compelling people to build small reactors or big reactors, that's, the market is making that decision, and that's not happening quickly.
I mean, you would have to just find some way for the government to de-risk those projects on behalf of the utility, on behalf of whoever's building the project. You need the NRC or whatever it is to
take out a bunch of the oversight and cut some of the red tape, and give tax credits. The IRA gives tax credits for some of that, but we aren't seeing a bunch of new reactors being built, let's face it. Maybe not.
I feel like that's a 2030 decade discussion, maybe not the 2020s
I think
discussion.
so too. And actually, all of this stuff is kind of just is much more long term than I think anybody expected. And what I would say about Kamala Harris is that, in as much as we can judge her changed position, or we can, in as much as we can judge what she will do based on her changed position now, she's basically going down the route of all above energy for the US, all of the above. And it's much more pragmatic than, say, Biden administration around about 2021, 2022, when it was, they had much kind of more ambitious green energy plans. Like, I think everybody's kind of rolled those back a bit, and it's much more all of the above.
Look, I think, and this is another podcast episode discussion point, but like the tech wars that are going to go on are going to be driven by energy. And when I say tech wars, it's the AI race. And if US wins that or China wins that, it really determines a lot of, you know, what the global economy looks like and who holds the, you know, global dominance, if you will, but that's for another time. So there's two questions left. We got a few minutes. You can think about this first one, and then I'll ask the next one when we come back to it. So think about, so who do you think is going to win? Okay. Just, you got some time. But let's actually, talk about any thoughts you have on what's may or may not happen in the next few days in the Middle East with between Israel and Iran. You know, it felt imminent a hot minute ago. Now the crude markets are suggesting it's not. How do we risk this?
It doesn't seem to me like Israel has any option but to retaliate in some way. And I think they've signaled that they will. The question is I think what the retaliation will look like. Does it look like it did in April when they demonstrated their capability by sending some missiles into it, or some rockets into a missile launcher? Or does it actually do something much more significant? And there is a theory, I'd say, that Netanyahu will, like, this is the moment. If they're going to attack the nuclear installations or the program, this is the moment. Doing that is really, really difficult because of the range they'd need, getting the aircraft across there, refueling, and so on, unless they have some capability that they haven't disclosed, but which is always possible. So it kind of depends on what the retaliation looks like. But I think it's very hard to imagine that they just let it slide. No, I think we're in, as I said at the outset, I think we're in a completely different risk environment now. We're in a, with the kind of regional Middle East war that people worried about for a long time is, like, there is, you're on the brink of it.
Yeah. So I guess if the retaliation is hitting the nuclear installations, that's one thing. But if it's hitting the oil infrastructure, that's something else. And that isn't a far stretch to think about what happens then to gasoline prices and the impact it could have on this election. So it's sort of like, hey, Derek, what's the October surprise that everyone's looking for right before Election Day? Any thoughts on that?
An attack on an oil export port by Israel, like an Iranian oil export port, that then prompts Iran to shut the Strait of Hormuz would be a pretty big October surprise. I mean, in a way, we're dealing with last October. Like, the October surprise was last October. It was October 7th, which is what has triggered everything that has ensued since then. And so we're still dealing with that. And that could be the thing that, both by affecting oil prices and then gasoline prices, and then changing the mood of the American electorate in a big way just before they vote, that could be the surprise. It could be the surprise in something like Michigan, where there are a lot of Arab American voters who are pretty angry about the Biden administration's support for Israel and Gaza. That could also be kind of the outcome of that October surprise last year. In terms of who's going to win, I send the FT's reporters out to swing states constantly. In fact, we had just had somebody come back from Michigan and wrote about it. And
how many swing states are there left in your
seven
view?
There are seven. And the big one is Pennsylvania. It's, if Kamala Harris is going to win, she pretty much has to win Pennsylvania and then the other blue wall states, Michigan, Wisconsin. So what I'm hearing from my reporters always, they come back and they say, boy, it was really Trumpy out there. So, and I, like, the polling is very close.
Yeah.
Very close indeed. Kamala Harris is up nationally. It's kind of neck and neck in all of the swing states within the margin of error and all the polls in the swing states. The reporting, and I, as a journalist, I trust the reporting, stuff on the ground. The reporting that we get says it's Trump's to lose still. That people are still, look, the economy in macroeconomic terms, the US economy is outperforming pretty much everybody else, has been brilliant. Unemployment is at historic lows, et cetera, but everybody knows it just costs too much to live here at the moment. And that is something that continues to bother voters, and they blame the Biden administration for that.
So it sounds like whichever party does a better job getting out the vote on that day, or even now as folks are doing mail-in voting, is who's going to
prevail. That's absolutely crucial. And the Democrats are now in with a fighting chance, because the enthusiasm for Harris among Democrats is real, and I think it's probably boosted their turnout a bit. The enthusiasm for Donald Trump among Republicans tends to max out at about 47% in each election. And that's pretty much where the polling has him right now. So Harris needs to, if she's going to win it, she needs to
capture
that. And she needs to do it in Pennsylvania in particular.
All right. Well, a couple weeks away. We'll see how it goes. Derek, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your thoughts. This has been really insightful. So,
enjoyed
appreciate
it.
The time, and look forward to connecting with you next time.
Thank you.